Well, grace and peace to each of you. As we gather this morning for a time of worship, a time of reflection and prayers and engagement. On May 2017, a group as Dorothy Jean would say, sturdy group of 18 found their way to Israel-Palestine in what is called Places, People, and Prayers, a cross-cultural encounter with the Holy Land. And Adam King was among those, as well as DJ Mitchell, Phil Yoder, and Louise Hernandez as part of the students here. So there was 18 of us, and it was a wonderful journey, but it was also very challenging. Carlos, what did I say, Louise? I meant Carlos. You're right. Thank you for that correction. So I just want to introduce Adam, since he is our primary speaker today. Adam is a third-year student here at EMS. He's married to Katie, and he says she is the strongest woman he has ever known. And they have a son named Jack, who simultaneously fills them with great joy and drives them up a wall. Issues of social justice and racial healing have become a major focus of his study while at EMS. He is the associate pastor at Rise Faith Community in Harrisonburg and is currently helping to launch a series of groups at Rise which seek to wrestle with whiteness and privilege in America. And after chapel, Adam is open to the possibility of further conversation. So if you want to gather around the table and bring your lunches over there, he's willing to share more from what he has to share with us today. So I appreciate him bringing this, and on your way out this morning, there are some brochures from last year's, or the tour that he was on, to kind of wet your whistle, so to speak, in terms of the possibility of 2019. And Dorothy Jean's giving me the thumbs up, so we know that we're still working toward a cross-cultural experience, and if you're wanting to think about that, 2019 gives you some time to prepare. So, anyway, let us begin our time in worship.
What is this place where we are meeting, oh, we have seen earth its floor? Walls and a roof, sheltering people, windows for light and open door. Yet it becomes a body of hands when we are gathered here.
O God, why do you cast us off forever? Why does your anger smoke against the sheep of your pasture? Remember your congregation, which you acquired long ago, which you redeemed to be the tribe of your heritage. Remember Mount Zion, where you came to dwell. Direct your steps to the perpetual ruins. The enemy has destroyed everything in the sanctuary.
I saw the Lord.
Yet my God is my King from old, working salvation in the earth. You divided the sea by your might. You broke the heads of the dragons in the waters. You crushed the heads of Leviathan. You gave him as food for the creatures of the wilderness. You cut openings for springs and torrents. You dried up ever-flowing streams. Yours is the day. Yours also the night. You established the luminaries and the sun. You have fixed all the bounds of the earth. You made summer and winter.
A reading from the Gospel of Matthew. As Jesus came out of the temple and was going away, his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. Then he asked them, "You see all these, do you not? Truly I tell you, not one stone will be left here upon another. All will be thrown down." When he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, tell us, when will this be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Jesus answered them, beware that no one leads you astray, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Messiah, and they will lead many astray. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All this is but the beginning of the birth pangs. Then they will hand you over to be tortured and will put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of my name. Then many will fall away, and they will betray one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because of the increase of lawlessness, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this good news of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the world as a testimony to all the nations. And then the end will come.
Lord, as I speak today, I pray that these words, these stories, these poems, and these reflections on the land of Israel and Palestine would be received, that they would be illuminated by your Spirit, that we would see you, and that we would seek you here in this place where we are now. In Jesus' name, amen. So, if Muhammad, our guide for this day, had not stopped us where he did, I wouldn't have seen it. The small symbol of defiant hope. We were in Hebron, walking down a souk, a covered marketplace. We had just visited Ibrahimi Mosque. We were bombarded on either side by colorful fabrics, trinkets, sweets, and baked goods. But there was a tension in this marketplace that I hadn't felt in the more touristy parts of Israel. Muhammad's description of the relations between Israeli settlers who had built homes or simply stolen them over top of this marketplace allowed me to understand where this tension came from. Stories of aggressive settlers throwing rocks, pouring liquids and even human waste down on the shopkeepers below in order to drive them out. The shopkeepers had petitioned the Israeli government to build coverings for their marketplace so that it would not be defiled repeatedly and they would be safe. And the Israeli security forces said, no, we will not. It is a security risk. I have trouble understanding what that security risk was until I looked up. Muhammad pointed out the guard towers on either side. They needed to watch them. The marketplace was a place of danger in the eyes of the Israelis. Security purposes equals control. So when he stopped us in this small culvert at the lowest point of the market, we gathered against this retaining wall with some graffiti on it. Again, I wouldn't have paid the graffiti a second thought if he hadn't have pointed it out. There were two items, as you see, spray painted on the large concrete blocks. There's the cartoon image of a man wearing rags, facing away from the viewer with his hands tied behind his back. This cartoon is named Handala. And the artist that created him created it as a symbol of Palestine, bound in rags and faceless, ignored by the world. The artist was assassinated in England by a Jewish Zionist terrorist for daring to create such a damning symbol.
And then alongside this stark symbol is this single word, hope. And I asked myself in that culvert set under hostile settlers, surrounded by oppressed Arabs, just down the street from the site of a horrific terrorist attack in the 90s in that same mosque we had just visited, inside a land surrounded by walls and checkpoints that stand as symbols of fear and humiliation, where in God's name is hope in this place? Problems. I'll just continue. Looking for hope in this land can sometimes feel like a fool's errand. We heard from theologian and Lutheran pastor Mitri Raheb during a people-to-people conversation in Bethlehem. Regarding hope, he stated something to the effect of, "I am not an optimist. You can't be an optimist if you're honest here in Palestine. But I have hope. And hope and optimism are different." When asked what hope was, he offered the nearly absurd, "Hope is knowing the world is going to end tomorrow and planting olive trees today." It's with this view towards hope that I have tried to make sense of what I saw and experienced in my time in Palestine, Israel. I started to look for signs of hope in the places where optimism made the least amount of sense. Where were people investing in areas that no sane person would invest? What are the proverbial olive trees being planted at the end of the world? And lastly, where are those places in my own life and in my own community? When we first arrived at Israel, it had been a long journey. It's the longest flight I'd ever been on. And I was exhausted, and we were all exhausted. It was an overnight flight. My legs ached. We just wanted to get to our lodgings in Old Town Jerusalem. We arrived around, I think, around 10 at night there at Israel time. And we were excited, obviously. I mean, we had arrived. We went through security, which, well, you thought TSA sucked. Just getting into to Israel is very intimidating. I've never felt questioned who I am and why I'm here. I never experienced that myself. So we make it through that. Our group is gathering our bags, and we're sitting around, and I notice it's taking forever. Why are we not going? And I realized we kept doing a count, and we didn't have everyone here. And we realized, eventually, it took a while to figure out what was going on, but we realized one of our own had been detained by Israeli security because he had a Lebanese last name. They detained him for over four to five hours, and they questioned him over and over and over, asking the same questions over, and he kept giving them the answers. He's an American citizen. Yes, his father was from Lebanon. Yes, 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 but I'm an American citizen. I have an American passport. I was born in America. I'm not Lebanese, et cetera, et cetera. 5 hours. We had to leave, and it was heartbreaking. Kevin stayed back with Danny. Danny was his name, Danny Aramuni. And so this was our introduction to Israel, is having one of our own taken from us right off the bat. It was so shocking. We didn't know what to make of it. And then we arrive in Jerusalem. This is probably 2 or 3 in the morning. We're walking into Old Town Jerusalem, and it looks like a movie set. And we're just exhausted. And we just want to sleep. But we don't know if we're going to see our new friend again. First day was just this overwhelming kind of sensory experience. We toured Old City Jerusalem. It was a beautiful day. Every day is a beautiful day. The weather never seems to change. And we visited all the kind of major, a lot of the major Christian sites in Jerusalem. And we went through a bunch of the marketplaces. And I was struck I was struck. I kept thinking this over and over during my day there, because when you have these expectations of what a holy place is, right? You have this expectation of what you'll experience in a holy place, and yet I kept kind of running into these shops that I would have just as easily seen at like Times Square or the Myrtle Beach or something, like these tacky little shops selling tacky shirts and trying to make a buck. And I'm like holding these two things in tension, and I'm trying to make sense of what I'm experiencing. And so I wrote a poem, and one of the things I'm going to do today, I wrote a lot of poetry because I didn't know how to capture my experience in words very well. I normally write well, but I realized that poetry was the only way to do it. So this is called Jerusalem 5/6/2017. When nothing is sacred, all is for sale. Kitsch and holy join hands, skipping down David's cobblestones to the tune of 1,000 prayers. Money, power, land, and worship swirling in violent exchange. Glimpses of true beauty and passion warped by flags of empire snapping in the wind, one after another, after another, after another. Miracles mingling with cheap t-shirts purchased by the unthoughtful. Instruments of war are not yet plows locked, loaded, dangling from the shoulders of kids. Concrete security blankets wrapped around cities, around towns, around olive trees, around children. Never safe enough, never forget, never again. Ancient stories preserved and guarded, roped off from the masses. Get in line or just push your way to the front. The miraculous is just a kiss away. You gotta go down to find the upper room, buried under one of 1,000 churches, empire solution to the enemy's holy, package, decorate, market, and sell it till everyone believes the oppressed, evil, and the oppressor righteous, while the rich skip down paved streets, carefreely losing another piece of their soul to be swept into bins by the poor and burned in hopes that the smoke might reach heaven. Another Jerusalem story. This is a couple days later that week. We had moved on to Bethlehem. We came back into the city, and we had a chance to visit the Western Wall. And the night before we visited, my mom called me and said, "Adam, I want you to go pray for me. I want you to put a prayer in the wall for me." My mom's been sick for a long time. She's struggled with addiction. She struggled with a blood disorder that makes it near impossible for her to ever feel good on any given day. And she basically begged me, "Please put a prayer in the wall for me." I said, okay, Mom, I will. I will. And so we get to the wall, and I go forward, and it's just this gigantic wall. I have a picture, but it's not working right now. And I come up to the wall, and I write on a piece of paper the prayer for my mom, and I stick it in the wall, and I put my hand on the wall, and I say a prayer, and I feel God's presence. And I look around at the people beside me, and I see them praying desperately as well. And I know God is there. And I walk away, and I breathe. And then our tour guide gathers us together and tells us the story of 1969. In front of that wall, there used to be a Palestinian village that was wiped out in order to make room for this very place we were standing, and I didn't know what to do. One of our group made the comment, "How do you feel about your prayers now?" I didn't react very well. I used some language I should not have used. I cursed him out. And it pretty much ruined the rest of the visit in Jerusalem that day, because I just was swirling in my head, what do I do with this information? What do I do when holy and oppression come together? And then it dawned on me that evening. I sat down. I was trying to process this response and this reaction. We were sitting at St. Peter's in just outside of Jerusalem, and we were doing a reflection. And I wrote this poem to try to wrestle with this. And I realized as I wrote this poem that my words could just as easily be an Israeli's words. Jerusalem 5:10-17. Don't you dare tell me where to pray. This is my holy space. This is my holy time. How dare you challenge my faith, my right? Of course this ground runs red. It's run red for thousands of years. I did not spill that blood. Those weren't the wars of my ancestors. I lift up prayers for healing. I jam my prayers into the walls. What else can I do? Where else can I go? My mother cries out for healing. She requested I bring my prayers here. How dare you tell me not to pray here? How dare you question me? This is my prayer. This is my time. This is my wall. This is mine. 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 I read this poem to our group when we gathered that evening. And I know the selfishness of this prayer, of this poem. But it's what drives so much of the conflict. Whose land is this? I reached out to my brother and we reconciled. We made peace that evening. I got his permission to tell this story today. But it was hard. We were in Bethlehem, and we had visited Bethlehem Bible College, heard an incredible lecture on Christian Zionism. We ate an incredible lunch, which pretty much we ate incredibly the whole time. There's my pitch, Dorothy Jean. If you want to eat some of the most delicious food every single meal, go on this trip. If that's your thing, you don't want to miss it. Trust me. So we had just ate this amazing meal. We were sitting around tables. And then we kind of looked behind us. I looked behind me and people. And we saw, you could kind of peer through the windows, like beside the buildings, this mass of people marching toward what we recognize as the barrier wall. We were just inside the barrier wall, the separation wall in Bethlehem. And we see this crowd of people marching, and we're like, oh, there's a protest today. So we went and watched, and then suddenly we saw people running the other way as fast as they could. And so some of our group went out to go and investigate, DJ being one of them, what was going on. It was Nakba Day, which is a day that the Palestinians remember the formation of Israel. Nakba means catastrophe. That's their catastrophe day. So DJ was out looking, trying to find, our group just kind of scattered like cats. Like, we just went everywhere. We were supposed to stay together. We had plans to actually walk through the barrier wall, but that was right out because obviously something was going on. And as we're watching, suddenly we see the tear gas canisters come flying in to the grounds in front of us and in the street just in front of us. 20, 30 of them just flying in, filling the air with this gas. Some of our group, including Dorothy Jean, get caught up in the gas. They're coughing and hacking, trying to find their way back inside and to clear up and clean up. We asked, but one of the things I noticed is the staff of Bethlehem Bible College going about their business as if nothing was happening. And we're sitting there going, this is insane. What's happening? And they're just kind of doing their thing. Someone asked them, does this happen often? Like, you seem like you're so kind of, it's so casual. And the person stopped and thought, said, well, usually it's on Fridays, and it's Monday, so that is a little weird. But it is Nakba Day, so not really that weird. We were outside about to go home, back to our site, And we saw this kid, he was probably my son's age, running around. And he came up to us, and he didn't speak English, but he wanted to see our phone. I don't have my phone with me, I left it back at the place. And we noticed he was carrying this thing in his hand. We were able to figure out that he was carrying an onion, a slice of onion. We're like, that's weird. Why is he carrying an onion? One of our group knew why. It's to respond to the tear gas. It's a way to flush out the eyes. You cut an onion, sniff it, and you can cry and flush out the gas that was toxic in their eyes and tearing at their eyes. This is a kid my son's age running around and knows to carry onion to deal with tear gas. What do you do with this? These are the barrier wall, some pictures of them, some checkpoints on the right. The wall kind of dominates everything when you're anywhere near it. They try to hide it, but it's incredibly visible. It's an obvious sign of division. It's an obvious sign of oppression. It limits the freedom of one people to move, but interestingly, it also limits the freedom of the others to move as well. Not as much, but certainly limits. I found it odd that I, an American citizen, could go to more places than either a Palestinian or an Israeli citizen could. Israelis are forbidden to go into Area A, parts of West Bank. I could go there. Palestinians, unless they got special permission, were forbidden to go into parts of Israel. I could go there. What does this mean? I thought a lot about walls while we were in Israel, because you also have, so on the right, you have the barrier wall, but then on the left, you have this crusader wall that surrounds Old Town Jerusalem that is a tourist attraction. You can walk on top of it, which I did. Some amazing views, I'll tell you. It is a great walk. You get some beautiful kind of vistas of Old Town Jerusalem. But I contemplated this distinction between this barrier wall, which is ugly and mean and cruel, and this crusader wall, which is seen as beautiful and a tourist attraction. And I thought, what does that mean? What do we do with this? What will happen to that barrier wall? We saw a lot of other walls and structures that once were great and grand, and they were reduced to rubble. In Caesarea Maritima, this incredible hippodrome was falling apart. They're trying to keep it together, right? They have this beautiful amphitheater. I don't have a picture, but this beautiful amphitheater. You could see all this Roman architecture. The aqueducts, pieces of it are still up. But if it's not cared for, it's crumbling. It's still there, but it's crumbling. And we watched a video, and at this point, I'm getting fatigued. I am fatigued. I am tired. I'm tired of antiquities, because this is like our second to last day. I was done, and we just wanted to go swim in the Mediterranean, and they wouldn't let us, because they're mean. I'm just kidding. We had a tight schedule. But we watched this video that kind of did an overview of Caesarea, and it's really, read up on Caesarea Maritima. It's a remarkable building project. Like, they built a harbor into the sea. They built a palace in the sea. It's insane, right? And so this video kind of tells the grand story of what this once was, and it tells the story, actually, not just when it was first built, but how it was destroyed and rebuilt and destroyed and rebuilt. Each empire coming along and capturing it and making it into their own. And it got to the end, and we realized at the end that it was essentially one long commercial for an Israeli resort settlement that had sprung up in Caesarea. This is the place where the rich people go to live now in Israel. And it just made me, I started laughing. I was like, you just told the story of how this place gets destroyed over and over and over, And then you're kind of promoting, but we are the new empire. They didn't say that exactly. But we are the new power, and we are going to make this place great. Well, what's the inevitable? I couldn't help but put it. What's the inevitable? And I realize I found a hope in all these ruins that we had seen every place we'd gone. And this hope is that walls and empires fall, every single one of them. They always fall. And that seems like an odd hope, especially because we live in the most powerful nation in the world right now. But I can't help but wonder, for those who are oppressed, hope is found in the ruins of empires past. God will rise up. God will crush the oppressor. God will rise up and raise up the oppressed. God will not allow those who labor under pain and suffering to do so eternally. And therein lies hope. So what does that hope look like in action? It looks like resistance farming, the Nasser farm, Tent of Nations, which is being encroached upon, blockaded. And yet they refuse to give up. They refuse to be enemies. This is on the left. It's their logo. We refuse to be enemies. These are Palestinians just outside of Bethlehem. They have owned this land for hundreds of years. They have obvious documentation, and yet Israel tries to take it from them. And their answer is not to fight. Their answer is to farm. Because if they continue to farm, they maintain their rights. What does hope look like? And I'll close with this. One of the hardest days we had was walking through, it was exciting, but it was also painful, was walking through the refugee camp in Bethlehem called Dehesha. 15,000 people within a square block, piled on top of each other in concrete slab square homes. Graffiti covers everything, but I realized that the graffiti was messages of resistance and defiance. It served as like a rallying cry for the people that live there. Later that day, we met with a school, an art school, started in Bethlehem. And I thought, who starts an art school in Bethlehem? And then I realized, why not start an art school in Bethlehem, especially that focuses on documentary filmmaking. And they have made some incredible films. And I realized that art is a way to resist. Art is a form of hope in the midst of persecution. Went to a secondary school where they raise chickens, and chickens are a form of hope. Because they have eggs, and they can sell those eggs to support the school so that kids who were cast out from other Palestinian schools could land here. It was called Hope School, and they considered themselves a second chance school. And oftentimes it was a third and a fourth chance for kids who had no support in their families, who were failing out of every other school, and they could come to this school and find hope, supported by chickens. What does hope look like? It looks like this. Hope looks like graffiti, like piles of trash and a three square meter concrete box. Hope looks like spray painted faces of rebels, children, little rock throwing Davids slayed by mighty Goliaths. Hope looks like Palestinian girls spitting bars against their oppressors, like children dancing the steps of their people on stages away from their land. Hope looks like cancer survivors pushing artists further, higher, refusing to give up on her charge. Malignancy will not stop her. Hope looks like art on walls and books on shelves, dreams realized in scale larger than could be imagined. Hope looks like chicken coops feeding orphan children, second chances and hot meals to nourish weary travelers. Hope looks like invitations to stay, hospitality from one much poorer than me. Hope looks like bullet holes in walls, wounds for dead stones instead of living. Hope looks like Dehesha. Hope looks like Beit Jala. Hope looks like Bethlehem. Hope looks like Palestine. Amen.
One of the songs we sang several times across the journey was the one we were going to close with. And may it also become a prayer in terms of how we relate to people, not only in Middle East, but in our neighborhoods across the United States and for other countries. So let's stand to sing together as a closing prayer, and then